Sometimes a pet just seems out of sorts, but there isn't a clear reason for the change in mood or behavior. And when that happens, you and your vet can't just ask your pet what's going on. So you need to do a little detective work. And that's where Dr. Sandy Sawchuk comes in. I'm Larry Mueller, and great to have her along today from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. As a matter of fact, she comes by about once a month to talk with us about what's going on and how to keep your pet healthy and happy. And Dr. Sandy, welcome back.
Nice to be here.
We have callers online already. I'll give the number, but the number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, ask a question there, and post a photo of your pet. You know, I wanted to talk a little about vaccinations. As we've seen this year with the measles outbreaks, some people are reluctant to vaccinate their children, and that can have far-reaching results. Are there effects of the anti-vaccination movement in the area of pet health?
That's a really good question. And because we don't have any like national database as to how many pets are getting vaccinated or not, it's all just things that we hear from other veterinarians. And there are veterinarians that are saying that reading from an article written by a veterinarian in New York City that they're starting to see some of this as well. And it's really scary. You know, I have been a vet long enough that I actually have a bumper sticker that says, "I survived the parvo epidemic." When I first graduated, this was not even a disease that we knew anything about. And I can't tell you how many dogs lost their life because we didn't have a vaccine available to help prevent this disease. And it's not like measles where it occurs, you know, in the past so infrequently. Mm-hmm. We are still seeing parvovirus in certain situations. And it, because it's one of these diseases that can survive in the environment for so long, you know, even if you think you keep your dog isolated and you just walk them on the sidewalk, they are still at risk for getting some of these diseases. And I mean, I remember as a high school student working at a vet clinic, seeing case after case of cats with cat distemper or panleukopenia or dog distemper. And even if they survived it, they often have like debilitating
life
effects with, you know, seizuring and, you know, just not having a happy life. And so, you know, I am a huge believer in vaccinating because it's, you know, those diseases are still out there. And I just don't want to see an epidemic again because that was not a happy time in my career. And it's wonderful now to say I've gone for, 10 years and never seen a dog distemper case, or a year and never seen a parvo case. And I hope to keep it that way. You know, the people that are afraid to vaccinate are often reading things that unscientific data. And when we start looking at how many dogs actually have adverse reactions to vaccines, out of 10,000 vaccinated animals, 16 had an adverse reaction. And that adverse reaction may be just something like a low-grade fever, maybe a vomiting, maybe getting a little injection site swelling or pain at the injection site. So it can be very minor, all the way up to anaphylaxis, which can be a life-threatening type thing. So 16 out of 10,000. And of those, only two of those 16 actually had serious enough reactions that it required veterinary assistance to take care of them. So it's pretty low odds, considering the fact that you are preventing, you know, diseases that are almost always fatal for dogs unless they are, you know, in the hospital with intensive care and isolation.
Are there any risks that circle back to human health as a result of pets not getting vaccination?
You know, and I think it's more, you know, people not seeing these diseases or hearing about them. And so because they're not there, they're like, well, why should I bother doing this? If you know, you never see a dog with distemper anymore, why do I have to vaccinate my dog for this? And, you know, and yet we're still seeing it in, you know, raccoons and in certain like inner city type areas. It still raises its ugly head. And so we're still seeing it. And I think part of it is that, you know, in the case of humans, this is my opinion, you don't hear about measles, you don't see it. And you start reading about, you know, some non-scientific literature on Dr. Google, and you make a decision that could potentially, you know, affect your child for the rest of their life.
Yeah. Sometimes, just kind of a related topic to me anyway. It has to do with diagnosis of issues. And sometimes even with human patients who can tell what's going on, a diagnosis isn't always easy. And I imagine it's even worse or more challenging, let's put it that way, with pets who can't communicate.
You got it. And, you know, when we get patients in, we are very dependent on information that the owner provides us. And I like to kind of look at veterinary medicine as a kind of a form of pediatrics from the human side, because our patients can't talk to us, and we have to be the masters of doing thorough physical exams, watching for maybe subtle behavior changes, and also being able to draw that information out of the owner. And this is probably so true, even more true for cats, because cats are masters of hiding diseases.
Yes.
And, you know, and they can have something very serious going on, and maybe they're just, you just are seeing slightly bigger urine puddles in the litter box, or maybe you're not seeing them jumping up on something. But I hope... excuse me, later in the show, to talk about some of the things that we call the ain't doing right cat, the owner that just is observant and says, you know what, there's just something not right with my cat, and some of those top diagnoses that we see and things to be watching for at home.
Yeah, actually, there's some evolutionary things going on here, isn't there?
Yeah, with animals, they, you know, part of it is that if they show that they're sick, they're either going to be, you know, kicked out of the pack, or they're going to become someone's lunch. And so this is, you know, this is what happens with wild animals as well, is they learn to hide their disease as best they can so that they don't become a victim. And even our domestic pets are like that too. We like to get flowers and we like to get sympathy cards. Unfortunately, dogs and cats, or maybe fortunately, they don't. And so they hide those diseases. And it's up to us as being conscientious owners to be really carefully watching on a daily basis for subtle changes in our pet's behavior.
Yeah. You know what? Let's talk about cats just for the heck of it.
Okay.
What are the five, let's say, top five?
Top five in cats. Okay. Probably... one of the number one things that we see is oral disease, dental disease. I can't tell you how often I open up a pet's mouth and see diseased teeth. And in the case of cats, they get this condition called resorptive lesions, which are areas where the tooth is dissolving and the pulp cavity is exposed. And when we expose those teeth to the air just by opening the mouth, the cat will often jaw chatter. And when we start questioning the owner, they'll say, hey, yeah, I've been noticing that there's more like crunched food crumbs left. They're dropping it from their mouth, or they see the pet chewing on one side over the other. And so that is probably one of the number one things we see. And I so often hear people that have had their pet in, have dentistry done, that they've totally changed when they get home. That once they recover from the procedure, they are a new animal. And it's because we've now made them pain-free by removing diseased teeth or treating diseased teeth, dealing with periodontitis or something like that. Probably one of the other ones that we see, and this is more in older cats, is chronic kidney disease. And we estimate that cats that are over 10, that probably about up to 80% of them have some form of kidney disease. There's actually a new test that's just been marketed by the company called IDEX that is able to detect earlier signs of kidney disease before we start seeing lots of kidney malfunction. Right now, before this test was available, we had to wait until about 75% of the kidney function was lost before we actually were able to diagnose that the pet had kidney disease. Now we're able to get it early, about 40% of kidney loss, and so we can do something much earlier for these pets.
So that's good. So
yeah.
Those are the top two, then.
Those are the top two, and the other ones that we see are degenerative joint disease. Simple thing. An older cat maybe can't get in and out of the litter box as well, so they may start having litter box problems. That you always had the litter box in the basement, and now the cat's decided that bathroom mat, in the bathroom next to where they sleep is nice and absorbent, so I'm just going to go on there. And that may be a sign of joint disease in a cat. You know, and we may see them licking at a joint or not wanting to jump up on things, but often, again, it's very subtle signs. But, you know, again, one of these things that we see is that in about 100% of cats over 12 years of age have degenerative joint disease somewhere on their body.
Oh, so
just
everyone.
Like us. Yeah, just like us. Hyperthyroidism and diabetes are also the top two endocrine diseases that we see, and they can look very similar. Eating more, drinking more, urinating more, and losing weight. And it's up to us as veterinarians to not only look for other clinical signs that would help us go from, you know, just diagnose one over the other, but also getting some blood work and having a look to make sure that lab work is normal or abnormal and getting the pet treated. And all of these things can be managed. That's what's really cool about it, is that you catch them, you diagnose them, and you can do something about it too.
Very, very cool. Well, we'll take some calls now. Actually, I think what we'll do is maybe next time you're on, we'll cover dogs and go over that a little more.
That sounds great.
In more depth. But let's go to Mary, who's in the UP right now. Mary, thank you for waiting. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. We have a 10-month-old Springer Spaniel, Miss Daisy, quite the handful, but adorable. The problem we're having is she is on her third UTI since about August, and each episode is taking about 6 weeks to resolve. And I'm being told two things, I guess, that it can be very challenging to treat UTIs in a puppy or a young dog, and that if we're at number three now, if it continues, we may have to look at something abnormal through a ultrasound or that.
What's a UTI, by the way?
Urinary tract infection. Mm-hmm. We like to use little abbreviations when we're doing our medical records. I would hope that your veterinarian has cultured a sterile urine sample to make sure that your dog is on the appropriate antibiotic. And if that hasn't been done, that needs to be done, rather than just grabbing one off the shelf and saying, and often for a first time urinary tract infection, you know, you play the odds that it's probably E. coli and it's going to be sensitive to some of the standard antibiotics that we use, but sometimes we do start seeing some resistant bugs. So I'm hoping that your veterinarian is culturing. And with recurrent urinary tract infections, the big question is it, did it clear up and then it's just come back because maybe your puppy has some anatomical problem, either a hooded vulva or maybe an abnormally shaped bladder or, you know, something, a bladder stone, something that could be causing it to come back again. Or did we never, ever get it cleared up again? We just knocked it out a little bit, and it's coming right back again afterwards. So typically, if we have a dog that's been having recurrent urinary tract infections, we'll be culturing before, we'll culture during the antibiotic use to make sure that we are actually getting that under control and that we're not growing anything. And then we'll culture afterwards as well to ensure that it's actually gone. If you've been going through all of that and your dog is still having a urinary tract infection, then I think it might be worthwhile to have them looked into. And I'd be looking at, you know, maybe doing vaginoscopy to see if you've got she's got a stricture there that's pooling urine, or, you know, looking at the way her vulva is placed, whether we've got some skin changes that could be causing an ascending infection. But they can be a little tricky to diagnose when we start getting these recurrent problems. And if your veterinarian isn't comfortable with doing vaginoscopy, it may mean a referral to an internist to have a look and see if they can get to the bottom of it.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it, Mary. Marie in Eagle River, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. We have a 9-year-old cat that was diagnosed last summer with pancreatitis. And on his most recent flare-up a few weeks ago, they found he was in heart failure.
Oh, my goodness.
After he got some fluid. Well, and the typical thing is you give him fluids because he's not eating or drinking. And he got fluids one day, and then in another, because he wasn't getting better, they looked further, and he was in heart failure, so he had a lot of fluid. The heart failure is controlled pretty well right now with benazepril and furosemide.
Okay.
But now if he has a pancreatitis flare-up, we're concerned about him getting fluids.
Mm-hmm.
And he's getting great treatment up here, but we're wondering if he would benefit from seeing a specialist at the veterinary school.
Yeah, I think it probably wouldn't be a bad idea to find out why your cat at 9 years of age has a bad ticker. There are things like cardiomyopathy, heart muscle problems that can be, may need to be managed differently. And so normally what we would be doing is not only taking a chest x-ray, but getting an echocardiogram or an ultrasound done on the heart to come up with a diagnosis as to what is causing your cat to have these heart symptoms. Anytime we have a pet with heart disease, we have to be really careful with fluids. And it may mean, monitoring central venous pressure. Being in a hospital where they can have 24-hour around-the-clock monitoring, making sure that we're really measuring ins and outs very carefully, meaning how much fluid is going in and how much the cat is producing in the form of urine, watching their weight to make sure that, again, their weight isn't going up because we're giving too many fluids. Most cats are pretty tolerant of, just giving them a, bolus of sub-Q fluids. But in the cat with a bad heart, we have to be really careful that we are accounting for their weight and, underlying health problems before we just go ahead and give them a bolus of fluids. So, if your veterinarian is not in a position to be able to have that heart problem actually diagnosed, then I think it would be a good idea to get your kitty referred.
Mm-hmm. Which kind of specialist would we see?
A cardiologist would be the first step, okay, to get an answer as to why your cat is having this problem with its heart. And then the pancreatitis would be something that we'd probably be addressing more dietarily, keeping them on a low-fat diet, being careful that way. So I think getting the heart looked at would be the first step, and then take it from there.
Is there any connection between the two?
Probably not.
Okay. Yeah. And he's a cat that has always had a lot of hairballs, vomiting up hairballs. Is there something with the pancreatitis that might be causing the hairballs?
Well, I always wonder when a cat is vomiting up hair, is the hair just going along for the ride? And are they vomiting for some other reason, like a chronic gastrointestinal problem? All cats swallow hair. They all ingest hair because they groom themselves. And the majority of cats will periodically vomit some hair, but most of them are able to pass it without any trouble. So I'm just wondering how much of that was an indication that your cat had a gastrointestinal problem that wasn't being addressed. And we were making the assumption that it was the hair causing the problem, but it was actually something just else. The hair going along for the ride.
Oh, there we go. Good luck, Marie.
First
thank you.
First step would be the cardiologist.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And then after that, an endocrinologist.
Or an internist, yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now, we're learning how to keep your pet healthy and happy with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. And Tim in New Berlin has been waiting a while, so let's go to Tim. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Dr. Sandy. Dr. Sandy, I want to let you know, listening to your show last time you were on is probably the reason our dog is alive today, because he had what you had talked about as the old dog syndrome.
Mm-hmm. Old dog vestibular disease, right.
There you go. Uh-huh. Thank you. Where he lost his balance, he couldn't stand up, and we thought that was it. And the day after he had that episode, you were on, and, he's been getting a lot better. My question is, he still has his head tilt, which is fine, but he seems like he's still, like, scratching his ear with his foot and shaking his head like there's something in there.
Okay.
We've looked, and I couldn't see anything, and I don't know if that's just going to be part of his daily routine or if that's something that, we should go in and see if there is an infection or if there's anything else going on in there.
Yeah, I get concerned because if it was this old dog vestibular disease, there shouldn't be any hypersensitivity in the area of the ear. These dogs usually develop acute onset of a head tilt. They lose their balance, and a few days later, they're back to almost normal. Some dogs recover totally, and others will have a slight residual head tilt. But I'm worried that there may be something else going on with with your dog, whether it's like a nerve hypersensitivity in that area where they're getting some funny tingling sensations, whether there is a middle ear infection that could be causing a problem. So I think the first step is, you know, having your veterinarian look in there with an otoscope to get a good look at the eardrum to see if it's intact or if it's bulging, discolored, to see if there's something like that going on. The next step, unfortunately, is going to be a little more involved, and that is usually doing a CAT scan, a CT scan of your dog's head, so that they can look at that middle ear and inner ear cavity area to see if there's any disease going on to make your dog feel uncomfortable. So I think the first step, get into the veterinarian and just report what you're telling me. They can have a look. If they see something, then obviously you're going to go to the next step. If they don't, then it might be something that you want to just say, well, let's just let it ride for a little bit if your dog appears to be fairly comfortable. But, you know, you wouldn't be wrong saying, I want to jump to getting a CT scan done. Unfortunately, it's under general anesthetic.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I thank you for your show, Larry. I love this topic.
So, well, good.
Tim, thanks.
For the show. So yeah. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much for calling, Tim. Appreciate your call. And, well, we appreciate all the calls, as a matter of fact. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234. We got a Facebook question from Jessica, who wondered if you'd discuss canine papilloma virus. I had no idea it even existed until my puppy's mouth broke out in warts. We take her to the dog park, puppy recess for walks, to visit other dogs in the family, and so forth. Apparently, social puppies are more likely to get it, but then build an immunity to it. My pup's mouth cleared with no meds or other intervention, but I have heard others say that they will be given antibiotics or sometimes even surgery. I was scared when I saw the first one in her mouth. It was like a pencil eraser, and I instantly thought of cancer.
Yeah. Well, one, it's very common in dogs, and we tend to see kind of outbreaks of it during certain times of the year, and it's when dogs are sharing toys, anything. It's spread by saliva, so if they're mouthing each other, sharing toys, you know, sharing sticks, whatever they're doing at the dog park or, you know, at your neighbor's yard, those are the way dogs get it, is with, you know, just sharing common things. It's almost like a rite of passage for a lot of puppies. Many of them will maybe get one or two warts, three or four, but not enough to cause any troubles. It's just that unsightly appearance. We will sometimes see dogs that get so many of them that their mouth is so tender, they have a hard time chewing and eating. And in those cases, we're looking at surgical intervention. We can use, there's certain like antibiotics that will help stimulate the immune response to get under control. And I'm drawing a blank. I think it's azithromycin might be the one that we use. I'm sorry. I always have to look it up because I rarely ever treat these because they often go away on their own. But it's important when a dog has been diagnosed with oral papillomas that they stay away from other dogs until they're gone because they are shedding that virus and could give the disease to other dogs.
Yeah, so it makes good sense. We had another Facebook question, this one from Barb, whose 9-year-old Cavalier King Charles Spaniel was diagnosed with liver disease, the cause being toxins or stomach infection. He's always got his nose to the ground, sniffing, and he eats everything in sight, including rabbit poop. Should he be muzzled when she takes him outside?
Well, you know, what I get concerned about is there is a bacterial infection that we see in Wisconsin, and it's pretty much all over the country. It's called leptospirosis, and it can affect the liver. And I'm wondering if that's what caused the dog to be sick. I hope that the dog is up to date on its vaccinations and that somebody did do some leptospirology to see if that was the case, because that's something that can be treated with antibiotics. And the reason why I get concerned about it is this is a disease that can be transmitted from the dog to humans as well. So there's a big zoonotic risk for the owners and anybody that comes in contact with that dog's urine. So that would be something to be looking at. I'm not sure what caused your dog's liver disease. biopsies, whether a liver biopsy was done, whether they cultured the bile from the gallbladder to find out if they had some type of a bacterial infection there. But those are typically the stages, things that we would do is ultrasounding the liver after we've got abnormal liver values back to look for structural problems or cancer, and depending on what we find, if the gallbladder looks enlarged, inflamed, we may do a bile aspirate for culture and evaluation. We'll sometimes take a little piece of the liver to be able to have a look at it. But, every dog's treated a little bit differently. I'd hate to have your dog muzzled, but you may want to look at using a head collar, a gentle leader. It helps control the dog when you're walking. And then if they do put their nose down, you're in control of where that head goes, and it can keep the dog's head elevated. If you do want to resort to a muzzle, make sure you're using a basket muzzle rather than the nylon muzzles, because the basket muzzles, they can still pant through. And so if they're out exercising, that allows them to be able to breathe normally. Those nylon muzzles that go around the nose and keep the jaw shut is for very short medical procedures where we just have to keep the dog from nipping while we're doing something, and then it comes right off.
Those gentle leaders are great. I mean, you can control... A 90-pound person can control a 100-pound dog with it.
And a lot of dogs don't like wearing them, and that same company that makes that particular device, the head collar, they make one called the Easy Walker Harness now that is very different than other harnesses, and it just gives you, again, more control over your dog. And I've had some people even use both with a double-ended leash, almost like, so they have control of the head and control of the body when they're walking their dog.
Very, very cool. We had an email from Joan who wondered about teeth cleaning. Her vet has recommended that their two 13-year-old cats have their teeth cleaned under general anesthesia. We hate to put them through it and also hate to pay the $900 it's going to cost. Wondering, is it really necessary?
Well, like I said earlier in the show, dental disease is one of those silent things that will often make a cat's life and dog's life miserable. And they may not show signs of oral pain, like outward signs, like we would hold our jaw and say, oh, I got a toothache. You may just see them chewing on one side, dropping food, maybe not grooming as well as they did before, maybe preferentially eating canned over dry. And 13 for a cat is still pretty young. I mean, we see them now living into their late teens and sometimes early 20s. And so if the cats have no underlying other health problems, I don't look at age as a disease that is going to keep me from anesthetizing a patient. So if your veterinarian feels it's necessary, I would think that it's probably necessary.
Katie in Milwaukee online next here. Katie, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thank you very much. I have a question. I have I think she's about a 9-year-old American Bulldog. We rescued her when she was about 5, so it's been give and take a little on the years. But she's a bit up there. And she's had a kind of a rough winter. She hacks. Whenever she gets up or gets excited and starts moving around, she'll spend a few moments hacking, and then go on with her life. But I also noticed that she seems to be a little less energetic than she's been in the past too. So I'm wondering what I should do about it.
I think she needs to be seen by your veterinarian. When we have a dog that's coughing, coughing is a symptom of either respiratory disease, like tracheal disease, primary lung disease. It can also be a problem with the heart because if they are in heart failure or the heart is big, it could be pushing on some of the airways and that could be triggering a cough as well. And we do sometimes see dogs with laryngeal paralysis where their vocal cords are not functioning normally, will sometimes be hacking and coughing because they've lost their protective mechanism of keeping stuff going down their windpipe. So there's lots of different things, and this is where it comes down to your veterinarian is not only going to listen to your dog, but also, if your dog coughs for them, there's different tones of cough that represent upper airway disease versus lower airway disease. After a good physical exam, my guess is that your veterinarian would probably recommend getting a chest x-ray. being a 9-year-old dog, boy, it could be anything from cancer to heart disease to heartworm disease to kennel cough to, you know, a whole host of things. And so once you get those initial tests done, then that directs kind of where you have to go after that.
Okay. That sounds like common sense.
Yeah.
Thank you, Katie, for calling. Appreciate it. By the way, we have some open lines. We'll get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Of course, you can always email us at talk@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. That's the title of our Facebook page. I'm going to get to that in just a second, but Kay in Eau Claire's been waiting a while, so let's go to Kay. Kay, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I have a question that's a little bit off the track of the normal pet stuff. I have geese as pets, 4 of them, and it's most of the time they're generally healthy, but every now and again something comes up, and though I have wonderful veterinarians in the Eau Claire area that have helped with my other pets, it's difficult to figure out who to talk to, what to do when you have an issue with something like waterfowl.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how to approach that. I know some of the veterinarians are, you know, quite good with chickens and things, but some of the behaviors and issues they're different.
Mm-hmm.
With geese.
Yeah, and this is a tough question because, you know, as veterinarians, we are trained to work on a wide variety of species, but even with that basic training that we get in vet school, I mean, I don't feel confident working with birds, and I would be referring anybody that came to me with a bird to one of my colleagues at the veterinary school that does avian work. And I think that would be your best bet is to either call the veterinary school and speak with one of the technicians or one of the receptionists to say, hey, up in the Eau Claire area, who does mm-hmm. avian work that would be comfortable working with geese? In Madison, yeah, it's a no-brainer. Come to the veterinary school. We've got,
right.
You know, we deal with birds all the time. That's a pretty long way for you to drive all the way from Eau Claire, especially mm-hmm. if you've got an emergency. So call the vet school. The number there is 608-263-7600. That's the main reception number, and they would be more than willing to try to direct you to somebody in your area.
Sounds good.
All right.
Appreciate the help. Thank
okay.
you.
Okay.
And again, it was 608-263-7600.
That's correct.
Okay. And I wanted to mention there are some absolutely great, wonderful photos on our Facebook page and some comments associated with it. Marie's got a photo there.
I see a family photo of a boxer and the kids. That's very
wonderful.
Nice. Yeah.
And Eric's got one of ISO, his 10-week-old puppy.
Sitting on a bar stool. They're really getting that dog out and about, aren't they?
He said he found his voice last night in his crate. Do you recommend having the crate by the bed.
I like to see the crate in the bedroom because, one, dogs are social animals and they like to be with us. And that way, for a 10-week-old puppy, if they are in distress, they have to, you know, eliminate outside, they wake up, you're going to hear them moving around and you can get them outside in a hurry, even in the middle of the night. Obviously, I wouldn't make it a big potty party and reward the dog for waking you up in the middle of the night. But I think just, you know, having that physical comfort of knowing that they can get taken outside is going to be really helpful.
And Nate sent in a photo of his dog, Hero the Border Collie, having it up for our wedding last September on the shores of Lake Superior. And you can see he's almost got his eyes crossed looking at the diamond ring on his nose.
I am just waiting for him to flick that ring in the air and catch it and swallow it because, you know, we do that with dog biscuits, and here they've got this beautiful diamond ring sitting on this dog's nose, and
it must have worked out all right.
All right.
It's a wonderful picture, that's for sure. Oh, my goodness. Well, Chelsea in Madison is up next. Hi, Chelsea. Thanks for calling.
Hi there. I was just calling because I have a 12-year-old cat, and she's been through quite a lot in her life. She's been through a tornado and lived, And she's had two litters of cats, but the last couple of years, all she does is lose more and more weight, and now it's getting to the point where she's extremely skinny. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering if you had any tips of how I could make her gain weight. She has dry food all the time that she can eat, and she also gets tuna once a day.
Yeah, and I, you know, this would be a case where having a cat with those symptoms, just losing weight, and you know, even though she's got food available, she really needs to be seen. When we started talking about those cats at the beginning of the show that just aren't doing right, your cat could have hyperthyroidism, your cat may be a diabetic, your cat may have an infectious disease like feline leukemia or FIV, which is causing, you know, chronic wasting. Your kitty may have inflammatory bowel disease, cancer. I mean, we can go through a whole list of things, but I think going in, getting a good physical exam done, getting some basic lab work done to make sure that, you know, the things that are very easily treated, like hyperthyroidism or diabetes, which isn't so easily treated but can be managed, gets ruled out, and then kind of take it step by step. But yeah, your cat needs to be seen by a veterinarian.
Okay, yeah, well, I think we're going to take her to a different vet because they said, the last one said, you know, I'll just keep feeding her and, you know, she doesn't have any, she's not coughing or anything else is, you know, her bowel movements are all regular. So
yeah, but
they
should have offered to do some lab work. And a 12-year-old cat, yeah, it could be anything. So time to find somebody else that's willing to do what you need them to do.
Yep, there you go. Good luck, Chelsea.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah. Call back sometime. Let us know how that all turns out. I always kind of like to know after the fact. We have so many times we wonder, I wonder how that turned out. Lee in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Lee.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Our dog passed away last April, and we didn't think we were going to get another one, but we're ready. And we've been looking at Humane Society because
mm-hmm.
we're an older couple, and we're looking for an older dog. Not a puppy, but we're running into a lot of dogs that have had kennel cough, they say.
Mm-hmm.
And I have two questions. One is it curable, and does it return? And the other one is my husband wants a smaller dog under 10 pounds,
mm-hmm.
and I'd like one that's about 20 pounds.
Okay. Well, that I can't help you with, because that's going to be something that a marriage counselor could probably help you with.
I'm wondering about is their health. Isn't it a little heavier? They're a little more healthier?
Not necessarily. I mean, we see some small, well-bred, small-breed dogs that are very, very healthy. I mean, the smaller the dog, you know, potentially they can have more issues with knee problems and dental disease and that kind of thing. But I think the difference between a 10-pound and a 20-pound dog, no, you're not going to see any difference in disease incidence. But the problem with kennel cough is that it is not caused by one thing. It can be caused by bacteria such as Bordetella, which we vaccinate for. It can be caused by mycoplasma, various viruses. And so we call it kennel cough complex because there's a whole host of things that can be causing it. And that's one of the issues when you start housing a lot of dogs in a kennel, is that they may come in maybe shedding these bugs, but maybe not showing any symptoms. And then all of a sudden, you've got an outbreak in the Humane Society that you're looking at. For the most part, kennel cough is self-limiting, whether it's viral or bacterial. Sometimes we do have to put them on antibiotics if we're suspicious of a bacterial infection. Often it's just supportive care until they get over it, kind of like us having a cold or, you know, us getting tracheitis. So I would not let a case of kennel cough deter you from getting a dog. I think that if they've looked at the dog and made sure that there isn't another reason for the dog to be coughing, like heart disease, which tends to be more prevalent in older small breed dogs, they don't have heartworm disease or anything like that, then they are adoptable. You just may not be able to take them to visit your neighbor's dog or training classes or whatever until they're over their bug.
There you go.
Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thanks so much for calling. 10 pound or 20? Maybe we compromise at 15.
15. There we go.
There we go.
You know, you really can't be that selective when you go to the kennel. I want a 15 pound dog. And how good of them to be looking at getting an older dog
and going to a kennel to pick one out, to adopt one. That's wonderful. Well, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today, she's going to be with us right up until 12:30 here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guest, taking a look at your pet's health, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Always great to have her along, and thank you so much for listening in. Questions about your pet's health? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Certainly love to hear from you. Kay had shot us an email wanting you to discuss your experience with Cushing's in an older dog. She has a 15-year-old mixed lab and believes that she may have Cushing's disease. Her weight's good, 54 pounds. Coat is good. Some of her symptoms are she's always hungry, starts eating her poop. She just had UT infections frequently over the years, had her on a limited ingredient diet, blue, and I also gave her canned food a couple times a week. I started to give her canned pumpkin with her dry food as well.
Well, this listener has brought up a number of things. Cushing's disease is actually overactive adrenal glands, where the body is making too much cortisol. And the symptoms that we'll often see with that are having a ravenous appetite, often losing muscle mass. The abdomen may become more pendulous because everything gets weak. The liver may get a little bit bigger. And we also will see dogs with urinary tract infections with this as well, because they're urinating so much and their immune system tends to be not working quite as well with all that cortisol in their system. We do sometimes see dogs with chronic urinary tract infections with Cushing's disease. When we are trying to diagnose it, it does take some specialized testing where we actually stimulate the adrenal glands or suppress the adrenal glands, I should say. And it does mean staying in the hospital for a few hours to have this testing done. But it is something that can be managed medically for the most part. What I'm concerned about is what the owner is believing is a limited ingredient diet. When we're talking about a limited ingredient diet, we're looking at a diet that is made in a totally cleaned out plant where we can guarantee that only certain types of protein or carbohydrates are actually in that food. The food that she's mentioned, blue or blue buffalo, when they started looking, there was just an article published in the AVMA journal where they started looking at these diets that are claimed to be, you know, only venison or only rabbit or whatever, and they found all kinds of other proteins in there. And so, you know, don't fool yourself that you're feeding your dog a hypoallergenic diet because it's sold at a pet store and it says limited ingredient or limited antigen diet. You really have to get one from your veterinarian. You're going to pay for it, though, that we know is made in a totally cleaned out plant so that there aren't any residues of other offending ingredients in there.
There we go. Let's go to Patty in Colgate next. Hi, Patty.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've had some issues with my 15-year-old Siamese cat, and, you know, he's still kind of in pretty good shape, but he started out with a blood pressure issue, bleeding from his nose. So we got that under control. He had an infection on his face, got that under control, and now the most recent thing that's come up is the veterinarian diagnosed him with a facial tumor.
Mm-hmm.
And we're assuming that it's malignant, only because that's what the vet said, that that's most commonly the cause. He's eating well. He's drinking. All of his bodily functions seem good. He just he sneezes periodically, and I'm understanding that that's because of, well, maybe the blood pressure, but also the tumor can be irritating his sinuses or something. But what's the outcome? What time frame do we have? Is it variable? Is there anything else we can do?
I've dealt with many, many hypertensive cats in my career, and I've never seen any hypertensive cat have a nosebleed from being hypertensive. Where we do see bleeding is often in the retina, that we'll see these cats coming in with impaired vision because those little blood vessels in the retina are you know, just susceptible to rupturing when blood pressure gets really high. So I'm concerned that that nasal bleeding may have been an indication that there was something going on in that nasal cavity, like a tumor. I'm not sure what's been done diagnostically, but usually if we're suspicious of a nasal tumor, you can do rhinoscopy, where under anesthesia you can look up in there with a fiber optic scope and maybe get some samples of it to find out what type of cancer it is. Sometimes doing a procedure called an MRI, which is a type of imaging that, again, is very specialized, but it gives you good detail of the nasal passages and the eyes and the skull and so on, so that you can see how extensive this mass is. And I think that would be a very logical thing to do, because there may be some type of either surgical intervention or chemotherapy or something that you may want to pursue once you've got an answer and a biopsy. And that is also going to help you with, you know, deciding, is this going to be something, how fast is it going to grow? What am I going to be experiencing with my cat? So that you can be watching for other signs and symptoms too. You know, just because your cat is eating and drinking, remember, that's a preservation response. And we will see cats that are miserable still eating and drinking. So it might be something to be talking to your veterinarian about, getting your cat on some type of pain medication. One of the drugs that we use quite commonly in cats is one called buprenorphine. We have to be careful. Some of the pain medications that we use in dogs are not tolerated by cats. And so I'd, you know, be talking to your vet about some type of care that way. If they're not addressing pain control, it should be addressed.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. All right. But you do think it's worth exploring it a little bit?
I think it would give you some answers that you need, and sometimes that's why we do this, is to be able to predict what your cat's life expectancy is going to be, kind of where, you know, what to be watching for. Even if we may not be able to do anything, or you choose not to do anything, that information may be very valuable for how you make your decisions down the road.
Yeah. Good luck.
I'm so sorry.
Right. Yeah.
That's all right. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you, Patty. Thank you for calling. That's too bad. Linda and Phillips, it's your turn next. Hi, Linda. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. My son had a nice 14-year-old... healthy-looking male cat, and eventually he had something wrong with his paw, almost like a paralysis. Is there some degenerative thing? He took him to the vet. It was like in his upper, as if you would pick up a cat by the front paws, you know, and you might hurt his front paw.
Mm-hmm.
But so my son watched it, and it continued getting worse, so he took him to the vet, and she said that it's something that a lot of cats get, and that it wouldn't pay to do anything, that it's just going to continue to get worse, and the only thing that would save him would be to amputate that one paw, or else it's going to go into the other side, which it eventually did. It went into the other side, and he couldn't jump into the litter box anymore or anything. My son kept him as long as he could to help him in and out, and so it did go from one side to the other. So what kind of thing could have that been?
Well, the first thing that comes to my mind is when we have like nerve pain going down a leg, I start thinking about something going on in the spinal cord, and it's sometimes spinal cord diseases can be one-sided, and then as they progress can start affecting the other side as well. So I'm worried about, did the kitty have a brachial plexus tumor or something that then ended up causing some problems on the opposite leg. That would be my best guess. But again, without actually having the cat in front of me to be able to do a neurologic and orthopedic exam, looking at X-rays to, you know, give you some answers, I'm kind of stumped. But I would, I think that would be my first thought.
I suppose just the fact that, the, you know, one side is so sore, you start favoring the other side, and then that leads to that side.
Definitely. We can see that. In fact, we'll see dogs that are maybe have, or cats that have a, maybe a ligament injury or something, and now they're stressing the opposite side, and the same thing happens on the opposite side, too. So it's possible.
No one around that would have picked him up wrong or anything, because it's just a household with his dad and him, so it was just kind of just came on. I says he was such a healthy.
Yeah, and this would be one of those cases where when you have unanswered questions and it's eating at you as to what could have caused the demise of my pet, always, always consider getting an autopsy done, or in the veterinary world we call it a necropsy. This gives you answers as to whether, you know, what your cat had going on. And it really helps with giving closure in a situation like this. So in the future, it would be something to be thinking about.
Yeah. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. And Cheryl in Conover, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I'm driving on Highway 29 from Eau Claire to Conover. And I just had to say one thing. The University of Wisconsin Veterinary School is like top-notch world-renowned. And this was not a paid advertisement. All I got to say is when it comes to golden retriever cancer, the University of Wisconsin School Veterinary School of Medicine is top. It's world-renowned. And as much as our dogs, both of our dogs did not survive the cancer treatment that was the protocol of the University of Wisconsin, it extended their life long enough to give us the closure we needed to say goodbye. And I can't say enough about it, and it's great to be back home in Wisconsin. We've been gone for 2 months.
You know, I am so proud of where I work. It's the, you know, every morning I get up and I am just so happy that I am in a situation with such dedicated people. And thank you so much. And dedicated owners as well.
Yeah, thank you, Cheryl. Thanks very much for calling. We are going to take a short break here next. So, again, I appreciate your call. Excuse me. And I appreciate your calls as well. I got a catch in my throat here. Give us a call, 800-642-1234. We'll be back with our guest right after this look at the news. You stay with us. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, taking a look at how to keep your pet healthy and happy with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk of the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. All our lines are filled right now. If you have a question for her, the number is 800-642-1234. Again, the lines are all filled. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. Or you can post on our Facebook page at The Larry Miller Show, and some good Facebook and comments as well. But let's go to Terry in Conover, who's been waiting quite a while. Terry, hi. Thanks for waiting. Terry, are you there? Oh, wait a minute. Yeah, Terry should be there. Why are we not hearing Terry? Well, let's try Tom in North Central Minnesota. Hi, Tom.
Hey, how are you doing?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I think our 12-year-old shepherd, Connor, has hip dysplasia, and we're giving him some fish oil, and the wife is supposed to be getting back to me on the other pill that we're giving him. It seems to be helping, but still, once in a while, when he gets up, he's got to arch his neck way up and just to get up, and then if he's running and makes a corner to the left, he'll give out a yelp.
Yeah, poor thing. You know, it's so common in large breed dogs as they get older to develop arthritis, and especially in the hips. And what I like to remember is there's a we use the term the WEDS program at the vet school. W stands for weight control, and I think, you know, really looking at controlling your dog's weight so those that are not carrying extra pounds to aggravate those already aggravated hips. exercise is still important, even for dogs with arthritis, but you do have to modify it. Obviously, you're not going to be, you know, hiking for miles or jogging on hard surfaces, but, you know, keeping that muscle mass up to snuff so that you've got good joint support is really helpful. And it may mean things like swimming or working with a physical therapist to develop an exercise program that is going to help keep your dog balanced and, you know, keep that muscle mass up. D stands for drugs. And you've already mentioned that your dog is on something that you don't know. But usually when we're thinking of drugs, we're thinking of anti-inflammatory drugs, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory, I should say. And there's other classes of drugs that we can use as well that will help control the pain so that your dog can exercise and lead a fairly comfortable life. Diet stands for the other D. And when we're talking about diet, there are certain joint diets that are on the market. Hill's makes one and Nestle Purina makes one that are enriched with antioxidants, fatty acids, extra chondroitin. It's moderately calorie restricted, so again it helps control your dog's weight. And then the last letter S stands for supplements. You've got your dog on a fish oil supplement. Our orthopedic group will often put dogs on a glucosamine, chondroitin sulfate, green lit muscle. Yeah, you know, so there, but you've got to make sure that you're using one that you know what you're getting in the package, because a lot of supplements may not be dosed correctly. You may not even get what's on the package. So, you know, dealing with a reputable company, and your veterinarian probably has their favorite. We tend to use a company called Nutramax that has a whole line of products, Deramax and Cozaquin and so on. So those would be things that you'd want to be talking to your veterinarian about. And then looking at alternative care, too, things like acupuncture, chiropractic care. I think we have to call it, though, spinal manipulative therapy in the veterinary world. And those can help with controlling some of the pain as well. So lots of things that you can do. And one thing that you may even want to be looking up is, as your dog has more trouble getting up and down, and, you know, installing ramps to get in and out so your dog doesn't have to go up and down stairs, mm-hmm. investing in a harness. So there's a brand that we like to use. It's called the Help 'Em Up harness that they can wear pretty much indefinitely. You have to fit it correctly, but it's got almost like suitcase handles on the front and back end so that you can help lift up your dog's rear end to get them up from a sitting or a laying down position a little more comfortably. So lots of things to do.
How about correct sitting?
How about
correct
what?
Sitting?
He likes to sit either on one leg or the other.
Yeah, and you know, that's tough because they sit in a position that is more comfortable for them, and they may extend a leg out because they also have some knee pain. You really can't tell a dog how to sit. So I wouldn't worry too much about that. I think I'd be looking at doing all these other things first.
All right. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling, Tom. Appreciate it. We had a Facebook question from Chris who wondered if you'd address symptoms and treatment for Giardia and communicability issues. There's a doggy daycare nearby that has four dogs in the last week with that diagnosis.
It is very common. And in fact, there was one study done looking at purebred dogs from breeding kennels and so on, and they found that almost 30% of them, of these puppies coming out of some of these kennels, had Giardia. It's an intestinal parasite, a protozoa, that is quite stable in the environment when you've got damp conditions. When you've got dogs that are at a doggy daycare and the snow is melting and they're defecating and you've got a dog rolling a ball through the mud and so on, that's just the way dogs get it. And so it's fecal oral. And because dogs don't wash their hands, they may lick their feet. It's common. Once one dog has it, the environment can get infected and it can spread to other dogs. Some dogs can become symptomatic. Others are totally asymptomatic and you can find it on a stool check, but they don't have any symptoms. And others will have symptoms of gastrointestinal upset. They may not want to be eating as much. They may vomit a little bit. They could have diarrhea. You know, so there's a whole gamut of things that we can see. The one thing that I think is many people get concerned about is that they hear that humans can get Giardia. The Giardia that dogs get, it has its own kind of species or assemblage, and we rarely see it be a zoonotic disease where it's spread from dogs to humans or humans to dogs. So I don't get too worried about people coming in contact. There have been rare reports in isolated areas of the world where dogs and humans will share the same Giardia organism, but for the most part, it pretty much isn't a zoonotic disease. We have our own Giardia. And if you get diagnosed with it, I'd be looking at what human fecal material you've come in contact with, whether that be contaminated water, if you're up canoeing or doing something, to changing a child's diaper and maybe not practicing good hygiene.
Perry in Conover is back. So let's go to Perry. Hi, Perry. Thanks for calling.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question about HeartGuard. It's for the heartworm prevention. Someone told us that if you give it to them 12 months a year, you don't necessarily have to come in for an annual blood test. Just want to know if that's true. We do.
Okay.
For an annual, but I just wondered if that's true.
Well, the national guidelines, the American Heartworm Association or Society, does state that dogs should be on year-round heartworm preventative and be tested annually. The reason is because, you know, they're preaching to the entire country, which has, you know, various levels of heartworm disease from where we have it here, uncommonly, but it can be quite, you know, patchy if you've got infected wildlife, to areas down south where it's a given that your dog will get heartworm disease if they're not on heartworm preventative. And I've seen, I mean, my own personal story, I used to have a Yorkshire Terrier years ago, and she wasn't great about taking pills, and even ones that are tasty, that are chewable, gave her heartworm pill, assumed that she swallowed it, and I don't know how much longer I was vacuuming, moved some furniture to vacuum, and there was a heartworm pill. Now, if that was one that was in the middle of heartworm season, July or August, my dog was at risk of developing heartworm disease. But, you know, I don't know when she spit that out, because how often do I vacuum under my couch, you know? So if it can happen to a veterinarian, it can happen to anybody. And, and so, you know, we sometimes are late with giving it. Our dogs may vomit it up. There's sometimes as mistakes. And we use a heartworm test that also for our neck of the woods looks at tick-borne diseases. It's called the 4DX test, and that seems to be pretty much the standard in practice. So even though the risk of your dog developing heartworm disease is pretty low, the risk of them picking up one of these tick-borne diseases is quite high living in Wisconsin. So annually screening for that, it just goes hand in hand with the heartworm test too. So I think it's really important to have that testing done. But do I tell an owner, I'm not going to refill your prescription because you don't want to have your dog tested? Obviously, no. It's very safe to use. Even in the face of heartworm disease, we can use HeartGuard. So it's not like the old medication where you could cause a serious reaction when we used to use a daily heartworm preventative years and years ago. We had to test every year before we would put the dog back on that heartworm preventative. HeartGuard's very safe. So I would still refill a prescription for an owner if I have a valid patient-doctor relationship with them. I've seen them in the last year, but I still think it's a good idea to test.
There we go. Good luck, Perry. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Deb in Fond du Lac, your turn. Hi, Deb.
Hi. I want to first thank you guys for the show. This helped me last summer when my dog was ill, and he has since passed. But I have adopted a 10-year-old Sheltie, and he has had, since August when we got him, he has had three seizures that I know of, and they only lasted maybe a minute long, but I'm wondering if that is something that I should be seeing the vet about. I've had other dogs that have had some seizures occasionally like that, so I'm kind of wondering about that.
Well, one of the concerns is that you adopted this dog as an adult, and so we have no idea when these seizures actually started, whether this has been going on since the dog's been a year or two of age, mm-hmm. or whether it just recently started. And so not having that history puts us at a little bit of a disadvantage. For the most part, if the seizures are happening less than 6 to 12 per year, they're short. The dog is, you know, comfortable after the seizure, doesn't have a prolonged post-seizure effect. You may decide, you know, to not do anything about it. We may not treat them. But, you know, we don't know what's going on with this dog, whether this is a new problem or not. And so I would bring it up with your veterinarian and just say, hey, you know, my dog's had 3 seizures, and they may want to do some lab work to look at liver values, blood sugar, thyroid levels, and so on, to see if there's something there that could be managed that may be triggering a seizure. But, you know, if they don't find anything, I don't know if you really have to take it to the next step, which would be visiting a neurologist and, you know, going through all of that. Maybe something just keeping a seizure diary is going to be helpful so you can see if they're increasing in frequency or severity.
Okay. All right.
There is one other thing with him. He's a big licker. He's not like a stress licker, like where he licks the carpet or something like that. But he loves licking our hands, our feet, anything he can lick.
Okay.
Could that be something that's a symptom or something that's missing from his diet?
Probably unrelated. We do see dogs that just like to lick us, and it may be the salts or other things on our skin that they find appealing. But there was a study done where they looked at dogs that were chronic lickers of not only people, but the environment, maybe licking the carpet and walls and so on. And what they found is that a lot of these dogs, even though they showed no gastrointestinal problems, when they put them through the GI extravaganza, where they did blood work and radiographs and scoped them and biopsied, almost all of these dogs that were chronic lickers had some type of GI distress. And so, again, this would be something to bring up with your veterinarian that, you know, this dog, we don't really know its past history, whether this has been like a lifetime thing and he's just really submissive, or, you know, whether it's associated with something medically. So I'd be, again, bring it up with your veterinarian. They may or may not do anything. It may just be one of those things that you need to train your dog not to do if it's bothering you. So maybe nothing.
There you go, Deb.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. We had, Shirley Bauman sent a note today, who's been a regular guest on this show for a long time, but she said, today is my long-haired dachshund's 20th birthday. That's in people years, not dog years. He came to us from the MAT, so Madison Technical College Vet Tech Program, at 1 year of age. So I guess he had a good start in life.
Yeah, you know, I see so many dogs that have been adopted from the program here in Madison, where the veterinary technicians learn to do dental cleanings and you know, drawing blood samples and so on. And then these dogs get, you know, they're well-loved while they're there, and then they get adopted, and they're just the most well-adjusted, easygoing dogs. And so, you know, again, how wonderful. 20 years, that's amazing.
That is amazing. Good for you, Shirley. Oh, and we, you know, we had an email from Mary and wondering about, back to vaccinations for a minute here, wondering about the current vaccination recommendations for cats.
Well, I like to tell people that if they really want to get into some scientific reading, the best place to look, and you can get this online, is the American Association of Feline Practitioners Cat Vaccination Guidelines. And these have been, they update them every few years. And so that's a pretty lengthy document that talks about all the different vaccines that are out there and, you know, the schedule and things that can be used. But I think some of the new things that are out there for cats right now is there has been an association between the chronic inflammation from certain types of vaccine causing cancer in cats. It's pretty low risk, but they can develop a sarcoma at the injection site where some of these vaccines are given. And so there's been a push over the last about 15 years to change some of the vaccines to recombinant vaccines, which are less irritating. And they've just recently come out with, since last summer, a 3-year canary pox or recombinant rabies vaccine for cats, which does not cause that local reaction at the injection site that can become problematic for the cat. So that's something that's new that may not be in those guidelines. But I tend to look at every cat as an individual and look at their lifestyle to try to determine what they need to be vaccinated for. Some of it's going to depend on their age. Like I said, their lifestyle, whether they're indoor, outdoor, multi-cat households, whether they go to cat shows. Those are all going to be things that we're going to look at to try to determine what vaccines that particular cat needs. We can't treat every cat the same. Like, it's because every cat's different. So, yeah.
There we go. Kathy in Marshfield has something for us. Hi, Kathy. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have an 8-year-old black lab that has arthritis, and I listened to the answer for the guy who had the shepherd. But my question is primarily on drugs, because she had last year tested positive for Lyme disease. I saw the ticks. She didn't get any prophylaxis. They did treat her with antibiotics, but she's also 8 years old, and this winter's been rough. And I can't find an NSAID or a drug to give her because she's, by the end of the day, she's really hurting. And I understand from my vet that labs have a sensitivity to like Rimadyl, like for liver damage. I do have a meloxicam, which I give her occasionally, like for maybe a day or two. She's not on it routinely, maybe a couple times a month. But boy, by the end of the day, she's really hurting. She doesn't like to get up or down. And I'm wondering if there is any medication that I can give her to alleviate some of the pain.
Yeah, anytime we have a dog with chronic pain like this, I think we have to look at daily management and not just using it intermittently. Meloxicam is a nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory that's very similar to carprofen, such as Rimadyl. Prevacox is another one that's out there. Deramax is another one. There's a whole host of things that you can use. Things that I tell people to try to avoid just because they tend to be much more irritating to the intestinal tract would be things like aspirin, which you can buy over the counter at pet stores, and yet it causes ulcers in almost any dog that takes it. Even if they don't show any symptoms of it, when a dog has been treated, even given aspirin with food, and they've scoped these dogs afterwards, they found evidence of gastrointestinal ulceration and hemorrhage. So what we do when we have a middle-aged to older dog that needs to be on a medication on a daily basis that's in that particular class is we draw lab work prior to them starting it to make sure that the liver and kidneys are working all right. We put them on an appropriate dose for them, making sure that it's given with a meal, and then recheck those lab values, 3 to 4 weeks later to make sure that they're tolerating the medication well. If they don't tolerate it for whatever reason, there are other classes of drugs that we can use. One that we use fairly commonly at the vet school is one called Tramadol. It's a human medication, and it is a controlled substance, so sometimes you have to jump through some extra hoops to be able to get a medication like that. Sometimes we will use a drug called gabapentin, which is used. There's a drug called Lyrica in the human world. This is kind of an earlier form of that particular drug, and it helps some dogs that have either nerve pain or arthritis pain. So that would be one to be talking to your veterinarian about. And then sometimes we will use acetaminophen and codeine, which has its own side effects, but that might be something that your dog may tolerate as well. But I think you really need to be looking at a daily medication that, and with appropriate monitoring, depending on the drug that is picked by you and your veterinarian.
And good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Jennifer in Milwaukee wonders, when do you neuter a puppy?
Well, when you're talking about neutering, this is a really hot topic in the veterinary world. We typically do it before they reach puberty, and because that way we're going to be controlling, one, birth control. We don't have unwanted litters. Number two, it will help prevent some of the behavioral problems that we will see. And when she says neuter, I assume she's talking male dogs. Some of the behavior problems that we see, such as leg lifting, running away to chase after female dogs in heat, being more aggressive with other boy dogs. So that helps control some of those behaviors. The controversy comes over the size of the dog. Large breed dogs, there may be some evidence to help those joints by keeping them intact a little bit longer. Talk to your vet.
And we can get into more detail on that next month as well.
I would love to.
All right. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk will be back the second Tuesday of the month. So April 14th is her next visit here on the Ideas Network. Tomorrow at 11, we'll find out about opportunities that the Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin has for people. And at 11:45, Darren Bush is back to talk about Canoocopia. Always great to have them with us, but it's always special to have Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. So we'll look forward to her next visit. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.